You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Monday, March 24th, 2025. I'm your host, Rachel Fields.
And I'm your host, Dane Bulow. In tonight's news,
the upcoming election sets a new schedule for the length of alder terms.
An incumbent alder says Madison needs to preserve equitable access to basic city services.
And in the second half, we'll outline the local government's calendar for the week ahead, share the story of Typhoid Mary, taste test some more shots, and review two new movies.
All of these and more on tonight's news. But first, we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. Large crowds have gathered again in Istanbul to demand the release of the city's mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu, Turkey's main opposition presidential candidate. He was arrested last week and charged with corruption. The chairman of his CHP party told the crowds the protest was an act of defiance against fascism. But President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said the demonstrations had turned violent. Mark Lewin is in Istanbul.
President Erdogan has got a massive security apparatus under his thumb. He's also got 90% of the Turkish media under his thumb, who are not broadcasting live from these protests. But if democracy and rule of law have taken a huge battering under Erdogan, there is one pillar of it that still exists, and that is relatively free and fair elections. And that is what President Erdogan fears, the 2028 presidential election, or an earlier one if he decides to call it, in which polls show Ekrem İmamoğlu, the mayor of Istanbul, would win.
The United Nations says it's reducing its presence in Gaza because of Israel's intensifying bombardment. Stéphane Dujarric is the spokesperson for the UN Secretary General.
As you know, in the past week, Israel carried out devastating strikes on Gaza, claiming the lives of hundreds of civilians, including United Nations personnel, with no humanitarian aid being allowed to enter the Gaza Strip since early March. As a result, the Secretary General has taken the difficult decision to reduce the United Nations footprint in Gaza, even as humanitarian needs soar and our concern over the protection of civilians intensifies.
Meanwhile, the Israeli military has ordered Palestinians to evacuate the Jabalia area of northern Gaza after rockets were fired at Sderot in Israel. Activists in Israel say one of the Palestinian directors of the Oscar-winning documentary No Other Land has been attacked by Jewish settlers in his village in the occupied West Bank. The Jewish Americans who witnessed the incident say Hamdan Balal was then detained by the Israeli army. The activists say they were also attacked by the masked settlers. The White House has confirmed that a prominent journalist was accidentally texted classified military information about plans for U.S. strikes and Houthi rebels in Yemen. A spokesman said the administration was reviewing how the phone number of Jeffrey Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Atlantic magazine, was inadvertently added to a chain. Speaking to journalists, President Trump denied any knowledge of the leak.
I don't know anything about it. I'm not a big fan of The Atlantic. To me, it's a magazine that's going out of business. I think it's not much of a magazine, but I know nothing about it. You're saying that they had what?
They were using Signal to coordinate on sensitive materials. And
having to do with what?
With the Houthis.
The Houthis? You mean the attack on the Houthis?
World News from the BBC. An appeals court judge in Washington has strongly criticized the Trump administration for its summary deportation of alleged Venezuelan gang members to El Salvador 10 days ago. James Boasberg said that Nazis had got better treatment in World War II. His comments came as government lawyers tried to overturn a restraining order that has stopped the deportations. Gary O'Donoghue is in Washington.
For almost 2 hours, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals wrestled with a simple question. Should it overturn a restraining order imposed by a lower court preventing further alleged Tendiagua members from being deported under a 1798 law only previously used in wartime? Government lawyers argue the courts in the nation's capital have no jurisdiction over the case, and more broadly, the judiciary's intervention in the case trespasses on the president's national security responsibilities.
Talks between Russian and US representatives on bringing a halt to the war in Ukraine have ended after 12 hours. The Russian news agency TASS said a joint statement would be released on Tuesday. While negotiations were taking place in Saudi Arabia, the northeastern Ukrainian city of Sumy came under a massive Russian missile attack, resulting in 88 injuries. Rights activists in the Sudanese capital Khartoum say at least five people were killed when paramilitary forces shelled a mosque. The Emergency Lawyers Network said this happened during evening prayers on Sunday. The Sudanese army has recently been retaking parts of Khartoum from the rapid support forces. Argentina's president has announced he will declassify all intelligence files relating to the period when the country was under military rule. 30,000 people are estimated to have been killed by the military authorities between 1976 and 1983, when democracy was restored. BBC News.
This is Rachel Fields and Dane Bulow with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison.
Over 600 people filled the seats of Madison's First Congressional United Church of Christ last Friday for an empty chair town hall targeted at Senator Ron Johnson. The event, organized by local chapters of activist group Indivisible, was an opportunity for community members to vent their worries and frustrations about the current Trump administration. They spoke of the removal of financial aid to organizations, the abuse of executive orders, and Elon Musk. Many had also brought their own personal stories of how the removal of government programs, such as Medicaid, will impact their loved ones. A mother spoke of her daughter, Megan, and how the proposed Medicaid cuts will mean for her family.
Husband and I have a wonderful daughter, Megan, who's 44, and she has autism, intellectual disabilities, physical disabilities, and PTSD. And she owns a condo, and her neighbor's over here, Peter, and she works two jobs, and she's awesome. But she relies on Medicaid, and if they take Medicaid away, she's not going to be able to live in the community. And as I'm aging, I won't be around much longer to take care of her. The rest of her life depends on Medicaid.
Dane County resident Leanne shared her opinions on the multitude of executive orders.
But I want to know what Ron Johnson and other Congress people will do to stop use of executive orders to rule our government. I do not believe that any president, whether it be Trump or any other president, should be able to run the country from executive orders instead of working with Congress.
Organizers told WORT that Senator Johnson was invited. He was absent, leaving only an empty, ornate chair.
Meanwhile, this weekend, local labor leaders held their own action outside the Madison Labor Temple on Saturday. The rally was organized by the South Central Federation of Labor, or SCFL. Speakers include a wide swath of labor representatives, from educators to electricians to retired Americans. They were all there to speak out against federal cuts to workers and communities. Here's John Nichols, a national affairs correspondent for The Nation and associate editor of the Capital Times, who alluded to another struggle for workers in Wisconsin, harkening back to Act 10. He told the crowd that they are not alone.
And everybody in Washington was amazed because hundreds and hundreds of Wisconsinites showed up to say, "We didn't elect Elon Musk to take over our government. We didn't elect Elon Musk to fire public employees. We didn't elect Donald Trump or Elon Musk to attack Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid." Those Wisconsinites sent the message out. We didn't choose this, and we're not going to let it happen.
Protesters picketed outside a post office on Milwaukee Street on Thursday as part of a day of action organized by American Postal Workers Union, reports Isthmus newspaper. The protesters were concerned with potential federal action to privatize the United States Postal Service. President Trump had previously attempted to privatize the mail in his first administration. He signaled that he is considered pursuing it again, although the first attempt faced significant congressional pushback. More recently, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy said he would work with Elon Musk's Doge to cut 10,000 workers from the agency. Protesters at the event highlighted that privatization of the Postal Service would likely hit rural communities the hardest, as mail service in those places is not profitable. They also floated ideas like postal banking, where the post office provides basic financial services to make agency more financially viable.
Recent campaign finance reports show that the conservative 1776 Project PAC has spent more than $40,000 targeting local school board races in our state, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. The 1776 Project PAC is a New York-based advocacy organization founded to combat what it calls critical race theory, although it has expanded its vision to include other conservative issues at the school board level. It was founded in 2021 with financial backing from Illinois billionaire Richard Uihlein. School board races have been attracting conservative political spending in recent years, with issues such as trans student rights and curriculum disputes driving grassroots organizing and large-scale spending.
A new study from National Bureau of Economic Research found that births across Wisconsin increased slightly after the 2022 Supreme Court decision that overturned Roe v. Wade and led to abortions being illegal temporarily in Wisconsin, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The decision led to a 0.3% increase in expected birth rates across the state, and the birth rate increased by nearly 2% in Dane County, the study finds. This is broadly in line with birth rates across the country, which received a modest increase in places where abortion was highly restricted. The study found the birth rates increased the most in counties that had abortion clinics that were forced to shut down following the Dobbs decision, resulting in a significant increase in the travel distance to the nearest abortion clinic.
Six Great Lakes tribes have withdrawn their status as cooperating agencies in the federal environmental review process for the planned Line 5 pipeline tunnel project, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Line 5 is a controversial oil and gas pipeline operated by Canadian energy company Enbridge, and it runs from Superior, Wisconsin, through the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, across Lake Michigan, and eventually reaching Ontario, Canada. Enbridge has proposed a new tunnel project that would allow Line 5 to cross the Great Lakes at the Straits of Mackinac. That tunnel project is being considered for emergency status by the Army Corps of Engineers after President Trump declared a national energy emergency. As part of their withdrawal from acting as cooperating agencies, the tribes criticized the process, saying the federal agency was no longer acting in good faith.
UW-Madison has sent a letter to department heads instructing them to cut between 5 and 10% from their budget for fiscal year 2026, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The directive comes after the Trump administration signaled that it would be limiting funding reimbursements on National Institute of Health grants, although that decision is mired in legal challenges. The departments have been directed to only fill critical vacancies and to curtail spending on travel, supplies, and equipment. The university has also signaled that it plans on cutting back on graduate student administrations to cover the potential loss of federal funding. The university has also received stop work orders on several federal research projects, although it has declined to identify which projects have been affected.
The owners of the building that houses the Wisconsin Veterans Museum are suing the state to dispute its purchase of the property, reports the Capital Times. The Wisconsin Veterans Museum is planning a renovation to be able to display more of its collection. As part of that project, it was planning on exercising a clause in its lease that allows it to buy the property it's sited on, which is currently owned by a group of Madison development companies. Those companies are filing a suit disputing that sale, claiming that the state missed a rent payment, thereby voiding the purchase clause. It is unclear how the new lawsuit will affect the museum's renovation plans.
And now for your moment of levity. A talking panda has entered Madison's elections. In a new ad from Adler Mike Verveer, the panda is pictured in locations throughout downtown Madison, blazing up on a porch in a dog park and waiting at a bus stop. Verveer has represented downtown Madison for 2 decades, and this year is facing a challenge from public health researcher Eli Servusky. The ad debuted on Meta and Google over the weekend. It's targeted at one zip code in Madison, according to political ad analyst Andrew Orwernd. WRT asked Revere why he went with a panda. He says he went with humor to stand out from the serious Supreme Court ads, and his friend owns the panda suit. Meanwhile, other Adler elections, a follow-up to the conscientious race between incumbent Sabrina Madison and challenger Sean Burke. In our interview with Burke that aired last Thursday, Burke claimed he's received harassing calls and death threats because of this campaign. WRT asked for documentation, and Burke gave us case number from January. A spokesperson for the Madison Police Department confirmed to WRT that officers took Burke's complaint, but no probable cause was developed and the case was closed in January. Burke maintains there are active ongoing investigations. MPD was unable to verify those investigations, but confirmed that officers, including Chief Patterson, have been in touch with the candidate.
Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories. This April 1st election will set up a new schedule for the length of alder terms. It's the product of several years of planning. WORT reporter Kate Poppy has more.
All 20 alder districts in next week's election are on the ballot, but half the districts, the ones with even numbers, are only for a one-year term and will be back on the ballot next spring. That's in order to kick off a new schedule for alder elections, so that half the council is on the ballot every spring. Even numbers districts in even years, like 2026, and odd numbered districts in odd years, like 2027. This change comes after a struggle to maintain institutional knowledge. When a new slate of alders are elected every 2 years, that means a lot of training on city rules and procedures, former alder Eric Paulson told WORT 2 years ago.
There's a ton of learning when you first join the council, and I can say that as someone who's joined the council a year ago. It takes a long time to kind of come up to speed and to learn things, and you rely an awful lot on your colleagues to do some of that work. And so when we are all up and we're all sort of changing over at the same time, you run into instances where, you know, a whole lot of people are new to the council and have to learn all this together.
Staggered terms could cut down on that. Voters signed off on this change in 2023. When asked then if alder elections should be staggered, voters said yes by more than 80%. That followed 4 other advisory questions on the ballot 4 years ago in 2021. Those queried voters on the ideal size of the city council, the length of alder terms, and whether alder pay should be bumped, and whether alders should be subject to term limits. Those were products of a 2018 task force examining the structure of Madison government, particularly for low-income and underrepresented parts of the city. That task force recommended halving the size of the council and the election of full-time alders. But in 2021, voters said no. No to a full-time council and to 4-year terms. They said the size of the council was just right, and the only question to pass regarded term limits. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Kate Poppy.
As immigration enforcement spreads out across the country, ICE officials were in Madison's late last week. WRT's Elliot Hughes followed up earlier today.
Multiple sources have confirmed to WRT today that immigration and customs officials detained a man on Madison's southwest side last Thursday. They made a single arrest, and the man is being held at a Wisconsin institution. We are working to get more reportable information. The arrest comes as the Trump administration is threatening the legal status of hundreds of thousands of migrants, urging them to self-deport or face arrest. Meanwhile, the Voces de la Frontera has a bilingual emergency hotline for people who feel they're at risk of being detained. You can use this hotline to report information about local ICE activity or to verify what you've heard. That number is 414-465-8078. For WORT News, I'm Elliot Hughes.
It's now 6:19 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Incumbent Alder Barbara Harrington McKinney first joined the city council in 2015 and was represented the southwest side ever since. She faces a familiar opponent this spring in Sammy Kilgey, who also ran for the council in 2023, but was eliminated in the primary. Top priorities in her re-election platform include housing, public safety, and transparency. Sit down with WORT news producer Faye Parks. Alder Harrington McKinney emphasized that Madison needs to approve a balanced budget, a budget that maintains equitable access to basic city services.
Hi, my name is Barbara McKinney, and I currently represent District 20 in the city of Madison. I was one of the first African-American women ever elected to the Madison City Council. I was elected Alder of District 1 in 2015. Which was the far west side of Madison. And then with the redistricting, I became Alder of District 20, and I've been serving in District 20. And my time on the council has been a very rewarding time, just being able to connect with constituents in the district. I want to continue to serve as an Alder because I have a deep commitment to the people of my community and a deep commitment to public service.
What is one specific achievement that you drove forward in your latest term on the council?
What I have done is to really being that voice and bringing the voices of individuals who, whether they voted for me or whether they did not vote for me, bringing those voices into the table. I am on the Transportation Commission and really talking and looking at transportation as it affects those individuals who are privileged and those individuals who are not privileged. Looking at housing and very specifically looking at apartment owners and looking at seniors and really lifting those voices up so individuals can share in the prosperity of Madison. And I think my greatest accomplishment is to stand for public safety, plan for open communication, plan to make sure that community voices are heard at the council level. Continuing to elevate the employment and training center and programs there. The employment and training center is led by the Urban League, and to have programming related to the constituents that's on the southwest side so that they won't have to travel all the way to Aberg to get services. So those are some of the things that I'm most proud of.
Housing is perhaps the most complex and sprawling issue the city faces. It impacts everyone from families trying to find an affordable home to college students trying to find affordable off-campus housing. A recent city report found that the income needed to pay Madison's median monthly rent without becoming housing cost burdened correlates to a full-time job, paying about $28 per hour or about $58,000 a year. This issue is so complicated, it's hard to know where to start. What do you believe is an achievable jumping-off point to address Madison's affordable housing crisis?
It is projected over the next 10 years that the population growth in Madison will grow tremendously. Yes, we need housing stock for the projected growth in the city of Madison. But the other piece is that we've got to address that missing middle, that gives individuals the opportunity to do wealth investment to eventually purchase a home. And as I go into neighborhoods in District 20, I'm going into neighborhoods that's struggling. I'm going into apartments where individuals are just living and just trying to survive. So yes, we have a housing crisis, but more importantly, we have a housing crisis and we have an accountability because we're putting the housing stock in places that we're not looking at what's surrounding, what are the resources that will support the housing stock that they're building. And I think that Madison is quickly becoming a place where individuals cannot afford to live. And we have to look at that. And so our housing stock has to be a varied housing stock where it can be reachable, affordable to individuals who may not be making the higher bracket EPIC funds, but they also deserve housing that's suitable where they can raise a family.
Madison voters faced an unusual choice in November and ultimately decided to say yes to a city funding referendum on the ballot that raised property taxes. Still, city finance leaders say the city's structural budget deficit is a chronic issue worsening over time. What is one way you would lead the city to address the budget deficit outside of raising property taxes again?
I looked at the stats of how the referendum fared in District 20. There was a very close margin. Of course, Madison residents want high-quality service at a price that they can afford. And so what it boils down to is that we and those who sit on the council and those who are sitting in finances, we have to do a better job at looking at what we can afford, what the priorities are. Yes, we would like to have this, we'd like to have that. But we really need to make sure that we are looking at the priorities of what we can and what we cannot afford. We must have a balanced budget. We must have a balanced budget. We have to do a more critical job in advocating to the state legislature, but we're going to be in a budget crisis. And so it is critically important that we start navigating and we start advocating at that level with the state budget, but we also must be able to set our priorities and say that these are the priorities that we have, that we want, the priorities that we can afford. These are the ones that we can afford. And so I'm going to be looking at a more intentional evaluation of what the budget crisis is.
I want to ask how you think about your role on the council. Alders have two priorities to their constituents and their districts and to the city of Madison. Sometimes those priorities conflict. How would you handle an issue that drives forward the city's goals but is unpopular among your constituents?
You as an alder represent the individuals of your district, and it is important that you listen to your constituents in that district. Then when you sit in the space of the council, you look at what is best for the city. And when that determination is made that this is best for the city and is not in sync with what the district wants, it is inherent for the elected official to then go back to their constituents and say, this is best for the city. That two-way communication has to always be there because I'm always going to go back and just say the why. And so if I go back to my constituents and say, this is the why that this does not fit for the city as a whole, then I have done my job.
Incumbent Alder Barbara Harrington McKinney is running for re-election this spring. She faces one challenger on April 1st in Sammy Kilgee, who also ran for the seat in 2023, but was eliminated in the primary. You can learn more about Alder Harrington McKinney on her website, BarbaraMcKinneyForMadison.com. That's BarbaraMcKinneyForMadison.com.
Before we go to our break, a quick correction. In our headline about a panda, we said that Mike Verveer had served on the city council for 2 decades. It's actually 3. He's served since 1995. You're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us because we've got a lot more coming up in the second half of the show. We'll outline the local government's calendar for the week ahead. We'll share the story of Typhoid Mary. We'll taste test some more shots. And we'll review 2 new movies.
But now, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll check in on some world headlines. Back in a flash.
I like ice cream and I like cake, and I like you to be my friend, be my friend. and you can be my friend on Monday, March 24th, by listening in to the Access Hour at 7 o'clock, where I'll be playing my original songs and hopefully making you laugh on WORT 89.9 FM. Be my friend.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
BBC News. There have been clashes between police and protesters in Istanbul as huge crowds gathered for a sixth successive night to demand the release of the city's mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu, Turkey's main opposition presidential candidate. He was arrested last week and charged with corruption. The United Nations says it's reducing its presence in Gaza because of Israel's intensifying bombardment. Last week, a UN employee died in a tank strike on one of its compounds. Israel has denied carrying out the attack. Activists in Israel say that a Palestinian director of the Oscar-winning documentary No Other Land has been attacked by Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli army said it had detained Hamdan Balal on suspicion of throwing rocks at Israeli soldiers. The White House has confirmed that a prominent journalist was accidentally texted classified military information. Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic magazine, revealed he had received military plans for US strikes and Houthi rebels in Yemen. President Trump said he knew nothing about the breach. 12 hours of talks between Russian and American officials in Riyadh about a partial ceasefire in Ukraine have ended. Russian state media say a joint statement will be issued on Tuesday. An appeals court judge in Washington has strongly criticized the Trump administration for its summary deportation of alleged Venezuelan gang members to El Salvador 10 days ago. James Boasberg said that Nazis had got better treatment in World War II. Argentina's president, Javier Milei, has announced he will declassify all intelligence files relating to the period when the country was under military rule. 30,000 people are thought to have been killed. BBC News.
The time is just about 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Rachel Fields, here with my co-host, Dane Bulow. Thanks for joining us.
This week on Forward Lookout, hosts Brendan Conkle and Rebecca Kimball run down this week's meetings. A Dane County board will receive a presentation from a diversified vegetable farm educator. The city of Madison will work through how to go about hiring a new police chief, and Madison Alders may revisit some of the community's changes they made at their last meeting.
Welcome to Forward Lookout for the week of March 24th, 2025. I'm Rebecca Kimball, and I'm here with Brenda Conkle. Hi, Brenda.
Hey, Rebecca.
Let's start with what's going on in Dane County this week, and then we'll move on to the city of Madison after that. So today at 1 p.m., there was a reclassification appeals board. What's that all about?
I believe that is about HR-related items. And in this case, it was the denial of a reallocation of social service specialists. So something likely from the Department of Human Services.
Yeah. And at 5 p.m., the UW Extension Committee met.
Yes, they are getting a program overview from the person who is the Diversified Vegetable Farm Educator.
I love that we have that in our county.
Exactly. And then they get a couple of reports from the youth group and from the director.
So tomorrow at 5:30, the County Public Protection and Judiciary Committee will be meeting a hybrid City-County Building Room 357 and online.
Nothing super exciting. They have a few contracts for the medical examiner's office, as well as the contract between Dane County and the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. There's a reallocation of a position for the crime response program in the district attorney's office. They have grant funding for the opioid abatement efforts. And then they do have an addendum to enhance the Medicaid assisted treatment program for jail residents.
But for the second week in a row, no amendments to the jail building contracts.
At least that we know of.
That we know of. Nothing on their agendas.
Exactly.
Also at 5:30, the County Public Works and Transportation Committee is meeting hybridly.
They have grounds maintenance agreement for the airport. They have agreement for the public electric vehicle charging infrastructure in many places around Dane County. They have a couple other contracts. And then they will be looking at the reconstruction of County Highway V, which is in the village of DeForest. And then they have a bunch of contract change orders. And they will be getting their annual report for the Henry Vilas Zoo Commission, as well as the Airport Commission.
All right. And at 6:30 on Tuesday, the Zoning and Land Regulation Committee will be meeting.
They have just a few items on their agenda. They do have a vehicle repair maintenance shop at 269 Rodney Road in the town of Christiana. They also have a dumpster storage and delivery service at 135 Hoopin Road. That's also in the town of Christiana. They will then be taking a look at Airbnb short-term rental at 6993 Applewood Drive. That's in the town of Middleton. And then they will also be looking at their last project, which is a temporary concrete batch plant that is on Reiner Road, and that's in the town of Burke. And then lastly, they'll be looking at the ordinance, making a bunch of changes for how they consider conditional use permits, which are things that are sort of permitted, but you still have to seek permission.
Yeah. Then on Wednesday, the Dane County Park Commission is meeting at 5:30.
Yep, they'll be looking at application from the Groundswell Conservancy for two projects. They have the Filio Conservation Easement in the town of Dunkirk, as well as the Village Edge Conservation Easement in the town of Black Earth. And then they are also going to be getting an update about the engagement and visitor services.
On Thursday, the County Board of Adjustment meets at 6:30.
Yeah, they have two different projects. One is at 2216 Calladay Point Drive, and that's a single-family residence. And then they also have that wetland issue at 7119 Schumacher Road.
Moving on to the city, earlier today at noon, the PFC, Police and Fire Commission, met to discuss issues about hiring the new police chief.
Yes, they had public input if anybody was available today at noon. And so they took that public input and then are looking at the police chief hiring process, including the job posting and public statement. We may be able to hear about that soon.
Yep. And at 4:30, Sustainable Madison Committee met virtually.
They're getting updates mostly, so they'll be getting one update from the Madison Parks Department on sustainability. They'll also be getting an update from Dane County on their sustainability updates, and then they are getting to know Sustainable Madison Committee members. I don't know what that is about, and then they will be looking at work group updates.
I think all committees should have a getting to know members part because, you know, they have to work together. Yes. And a lot of times that part is overlooked in committees.
Especially now that everything is virtual. It used to be you'd show up to a meeting 5-10 minutes earlier, chit chat with people, maybe stick around afterwards and chit chat with people.
Yep.
We sort of don't have that opportunity anymore.
Yeah. All right. Tomorrow at 4:30, the Common Council Executive Committee is meeting before the Common Council meeting.
Yeah, they won't be doing much. They'll be looking at their accomplishments recap, as well as getting all their committee updates and council office updates. This will be the last meeting of this particular configuration of the Common Council Executive Committee. And then they will, after the election, they'll reappoint new members.
Great. And at 6:30 tomorrow, the Common Council is meeting.
They are. First, they'll do some honoring resolution for World Migratory Bird Day, Earth Day, and Transgender Day of Visibility. So they'll be doing that first, and then they'll be getting an update by their government affairs team. They'll be getting a briefing on the state legislative affairs.
Is that from their new lobbyist, Bob, what's his name?
Bob Welch.
Bob Welch.
I'm unclear if he's considered part of the team or not, or if this is just more internal. So we'll see. Different departments have been giving updates for the last few city council meetings. So,
I see.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm guessing probably they're not quite ready yet for an update, but we'll see. There'll also be a landmarks nomination for a building at 633 East Johnson, which is the Benjamin and Amy Butts house. There will be a liquor license for the Strictly Disc Record Store Day. And then they will also be looking at the request for proposals for the Brayton lot, which is at 1 South Butler Street. That's a huge block by the Jeff Buildings that is going to be redeveloped. Oh, the Downtown Central Business Improvement District is getting another $62,000 for events around the Capitol Square and State Street. And then finally, they will be adopting the State Street Pedestrian Mall Experiment Report, as well as reconsidering which committees they are going to get rid of. Alder Nasra Wahili has asked for reconsideration. They almost defeated it 10-7, I believe, at the last council meeting. And so if she comes back, there may be 11 votes to stop the elimination of some of the committees, particularly, I think, the Public Safety Review Committee. That's where they had the most discussion.
That was that the only one being eliminated? Like, there were others who are being joined to other committees, combined. But I think, was that the only elimination?
There was one that was being sort of delayed before they got rid of it. But yes. Okay.
So on Wednesday at 4:30, the Water Utility Board will meet.
So they'll be adjusting their budget, and that will be to extend a new water main along Midtown Road and improve system redundancy and hydraulic conditions ahead of adjacent development projects. So big mouthful there, but that's the only agenda item they have besides their monthly reports. And the reports we'll be getting will be about water production, financial conditions, capital projects, and operations.
And on Thursday, the last meeting of the week for the city, at 5 p.m., the Disability Rights Commission will be meeting.
And they have they're going to be talking about the Week Without Driving Challenge. They have a planning group for that, and they have a website that you can check out if you're interested in that. And then they will be looking at revitalizing Madison's ADA transition plan, and then talking about digital inclusion and accessible Madison updates. And then they also have a bunch of reports.
Well, that's the week ahead in local government. Thank you, Brenda. Find more news about the week ahead at forwardlookout.com. There you can find a roundup of local news articles each day and the link to ask us a question and have us answer it for you on air. Any questions yet?
No questions yet.
One day there will be one.
Unless I missed one, but nope.
For more information, check out the extended version on the WORT website. We'll be back next week with more updates on the city and Dane County. Keep watching, keep listening.
Thanks, Rebecca.
This Thursday, March 27th, is the anniversary of Mary Mallon's second quarantine. Better known as Typhoid Mary, Mallon unknowingly passed the disease to the wealthy people she cooked for. She was one of 200 super spreaders in New York at the time, but received the most severe punishment because she was a poor, working-class Irish woman. Feature contributor Harry Richardson has the story.
For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters, up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered, who struggled brave and long. For the Union men and women, standing up and standing strong.
This Thursday, March 27th, is the anniversary in 1915 of the second quarantining of Mary Mallon, better known as Typhoid Mary. She was a typhoid carrier with those symptoms, asymptomatic, what we might today call a super spreader. She had three strikes against her. She was female, an Irish immigrant, and poor. Mallon was born on September 23, 1869, Cookstown, County Tyrone, today's Northern Ireland. She immigrated to the U.S. in 1884 at age 15, living briefly with an aunt and uncle in New York and working as a maid before becoming a cook for rich families. There were few job opportunities for uneducated immigrant women then, or Irish men for that matter, so this would have been considered a pretty good job. Mallon unknowingly spread typhoid fever through the dishes she prepared. In the summer of 1906, she cooked for the Warren family, of whom 6 out of 11 came down with typhoid fever. The Warrens hired George Soper, a self-proclaimed sanitary engineer, to investigate. He eventually traced the outbreak to Mary, along with typhoid, at 6 of her other places of employment. This prompted the New York City health inspector, Dr. Josephine Baker, and the police to take Mallon by force to a nearby hospital. Like many people, Mallon could not fathom that a healthy-looking person could transmit disease. Throughout her life, she swore her innocence, claiming she had never had the disease. Against her will, she underwent multiple physical examinations that included stool samples, which revealed Salmonella typhi bacteria. Mellon was then quarantined at Northern Brothers Island for 2 years without charge or trial. This was a small island in New York City's East River near Rikers Island. Mellon hired a lawyer who petitioned for a release on June 28, 1909. Before a judge, she testified that she was healthy and had never made others ill. The judge denied her request, saying she was a threat to public health. It was Mellon's status as a poor Irish immigrant woman that made her susceptible to becoming the city's scapegoat. Soper described her as an Irish woman, about 40 years of age, tall, heavy, and single. Newspapers treated Mellon as either a germ receptacle or as a wild animal to be contained. Woman, typhoid factory, held as a prisoner, stayed one headline, which in New York read a Tacoma Times headline. The so-called facts came from Soper and public health authorities and include irrelevant and defamatory mentions of her ethnicity, appearance, and marital status. Other healthy carriers were not slandered in the press this way. Mellon was never interviewed. The media just reprinted segments of a letter to her attorney where she declared her innocence. Her infamous nickname, coined at a medical conference and then repeated by the Journal of the American Medical Association, shifted Mellon's public image from human incubator to villain. An image introduced in the New York American newspaper on June 20th, 1909. The headline, Typhoid Mary, The Extraordinary Predicament of Mary Mellon, a Prisoner on New York's Quarantine Hospital Island, extended over a full-page drawing of a cook sautéing a cluster of skulls in her skillet. This forever cemented the misconception that Mellon's disease transmission was murderously intentional. After that, news stories compared other healthy carriers to Typhoid Mary. These people were occasionally briefly detained at hospitals, but none were treated as poorly as Mellon. Approximately 400 other healthy carriers had also been identified in the New York area at the time of Mellon's trial. None were arrested, tried, or imprisoned, but unlike Mellon, they did not cook for rich people. The new state health commissioner finally released Mellon in 1910 on the condition she stop working as a cook and take other reasonable precautions. But with few options and not believing she had a disease, Mellon began cooking again at restaurants, hotels, and lastly, the Sloan Hospital for Women. When more than 20 cases of typhoid erupted there, she was identified as the source. Mellon unknowingly spread the disease to at least 53 people in rich households, three of whom died between 1900 and 1915. On March 26, 1915, the Public Health Department took Mellon back to North Brother Island for the rest of her life. She lived and worked at the hospital there until she died of pneumonia in 1938. There is no record of typhoid outbreaks during her stay. Hopefully, the revelations of Mary Mellon's true story will have a positive impact on future pandemic reactions to future super spreaders. For the past in the past, I'm Harry Richardson.
It's now 6:48 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Feature contributor Charlie Bielowski is back with another Madison Mixology, continuing his shot special with fellow bartender Riley Capel. Today, they discuss the pineapple upside down cake shot and the many different ways to make it.
Hey there, everybody, and welcome back to another installment of the Shot Special for Madison Mixology. I'm your host and favorite segmentist, Charlie Bielowski. Today, we're picking up where we left off with another famous shot. So moving on from the pancakes and syrup shot, we move to the pineapple upside down cake shot, which is the next on our list. This was actually introduced to us by Naraya, who is a fellow bartender with us, and she was the one that actually originally told me about this. I will admit, this definitely tastes like a pineapple upside down cake shot. So there's a number of different ways to make the pineapple upside down cake shot from what I've found. Some of them include vanilla vodka, some of them include different types of cream liqueurs, but the most simple way that I found and the way that Naraya actually showed us how to make it was with three simple ingredients, that being the butterscotch schnapps, the pineapple juice, and the grenadine, usually split up evenly three ways.
Have you ever had actual upside down pineapple cake?
Pineapple upside down cake?
Whatever it is.
I have not actually. It's definitely something that I'd want to try.
but never something that I've ever crossed paths with.
I was about to say the same thing. I don't think I've even seen it anywhere. I know it was very popular in the early 1920s and kind of that era, but I guess it's not really something that stuck as a staple of desserts in America.
I would agree. I haven't really found much on the history of the shot either, which is kind of crazy to think about. The one thing when it comes to the shot is just the fact that there's so many different ways to make this. The bar that we're sitting at right now, Splash Martini Bar, they actually have their own version of the pineapple upside down cake, but in the version of a martini, which we will probably be trying in later broadcasts. But as of right now, we're sticking with the shot. It's definitely, once you give it kind of like that smell, it's definitely that butterscotch schnapps that's in there.
Yeah, so tell me what's all in here.
It's the butterscotch schnapps. It's grenadine and it's pineapple juice. It's three simple ingredients, easy to make, like a high impact drink. But I will say that butterscotch schnapps definitely overpowers a lot of everything else that's in there.
Yeah, you can definitely smell the butterscotch in it. When I pictured this shot in my head, I pictured it to be more of the color of pineapple, but it's got almost a deep red to it, which I wasn't really expecting, but it makes sense with the grenadine in there that it would be that color.
A lot of the pictures that you might see over the internet when you look up like a pineapple upside down cake shot show that red in there from the grenadine, but it tends to just sit on the bottom while a lot of the other colors kind of move to the top. And if you look at this drink, actually, you can kind of see that.
Yeah, you can see the different layers in there. It's definitely more red on the bottom and yellower towards the
top. And it kind of moves up towards the top. I agree. It definitely gets a little bit higher there. So let's move on to this pineapple upside down cake shot. I think we've kind of bantered enough.
Yeah, let's see what this is all
about. We've got these right here. We're going to give them a try and, you know, down the hatch. Very citrusy, but it's definitely, I'd almost say that the grenadine almost masks it too much. I don't know if there's too much grenadine in there. You can definitely taste everything else. And I will admit, this does taste like a pineapple upside down cake. We're going back to the shots from before, like the car bomb and the lunchbox, where a lot of that liquor is definitely masked. I mean, I suppose to be fair, the liquor content of this shot is very low. It's nowhere near as high as anything else. I think butterscotch schnapps has that same like 20% sure. alcohol by volume, which isn't too high, especially when it gets kind of mixed in with all these other non-alcoholic mixers. But I will say it was definitely, that is definitely a pineapple upside down cake. I would ever guess something like that.
Yeah, I thought it was a very pleasant shot to take. It has a very bold flavor, but you definitely can't taste the alcohol in it. It reminds me of something, and I can't put my finger on what it is, but it was a very pleasant shot.
It was. I really enjoyed that one. That was very nice. I'm a big fan of that one.
Normally, I'm not a huge fan of pineapple, but you really couldn't taste that pineapple flavor.
Honestly, it was an afterthought in the drink. The grenadine was so much more present. It was much more loud than anything else in the drink.
That's all I have for you this week. Tune in next week for another installment of The Shot Special with Madison Mixology. I'm Charlie Bielowski.
Today, featured contributor Harry Richardson reviews two new movies on the small screen. Harry says The American Society of Magical Negroes is a mild satire that never gets below the surface. And he says Back in Action is a fun but predictable action-adventure comedy.
White people feeling uncomfortable precedes a lot of bad stuff for us. That's why we fight white discomfort every day. Because the happier they are, the safer we are.
That was a clip from the trailer for The American Society of Magical Negroes, written, directed, and produced by Kobe Libel. I thought this was a fun, light satire with a good cast and an intriguing premise. However, it was panned by the critics with 25%, but received a 61% from the audience on the Rotten Tomatoes scale. As usual, I come down closer to the audience. Our story starts with Aaron, Justice Smith, making his way apologetically through a sea of white people at an art gallery. He wants someone to buy his yarn sculpture. Aaron is observed by an older African-American bartender, Roger, a great David Allen Greer. A dejected Aaron heads home after an embarrassing run-in with the gallery owner and no sale of his art. He tosses it in the back alley dumpster. Lucky for him, he is followed by Roger, who it turns out is more than he seems. Roger makes Aaron a unique offer. Aaron listens skeptically and goes along with Roger. Roger asks thoughtfully, "Do you have any serious health problems, like a heart condition or anything?" A puzzled Aaron says, "No, why would you ask that?" He is suddenly magically whisked away to a building in Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's Virginia home. They had been in Los Angeles moments before. Aaron is shocked, but Roger patiently explains that he is offering Aaron a well-paying job with the American Society of Magical Negroes. Roger explains, "You know, I mean it as a compliment that I have never seen anyone so uncomfortable walking through a crowd of white people." Roger ushers a bewildered Aaron into an orientation of newbies to the society. The lecturer, played with wry humor and majesty by Ayesha Hines, with a magical puff of smoke, she shows some of the greats in the society's history, calming white fears and helping them get what they want. There's a fun cameo with society president Dee Dee Nicole Byer. The film's central conceit is that the magical African Americans are making the world safer for black people, calming one anxious white person at a time. Roger shows Aaron how it's done by arranging for a white cop to get a successful night in the town. The clear implication is that if they don't, he will take out his discomfort on black people. Unfortunately, this is as close to a serious scene as the film gets. The next day, Aaron goes for coffee before heading out on his first assignment and meets cute Lizzie, Anli Bogan, and their immediate chemistry sets off the story's central tension. Aaron's first client is Jason, and unfortunately for him, the job has become a twofer. He has to help an insecure but entitled white guy with two needs, recognition at the job and help with his social life. All in all, a fun, lighthearted satire, mainly enjoyable for the interactions of its cast, especially Smith and Greer and Smith and Bogan. I look forward to seeing these actors in future, better movies. Unfortunately, the movie, which is supposed to be about discomfort, never challenges its audience to look at the root causes of what is going on, a systemic racism that permeates the broader culture. Up next, a new action comedy.
15 years ago, me and your mom were non-official cover operatives for the CIA.
But we went off the grid to start a family.
That was a clip from the trailer for Back in Action, directed by Seth Gordon. This was a fun, if predictable, action comedy. Matt, Jamie Foxx, and Emily, Cameron Diaz, play two spies who fall in love, but their mission goes south about the time Emily tells Matt she is pregnant. Matt is all in. They only have one problem. Spying is a risky business. They're talking on a plane after supposedly completing a successful mission. They have obtained a valuable key that can take over any computerized system. But suddenly, the plane's crew, who are supposed to be working with them, go on the attack. In the confusion, a stray bullet hits the pilot and the plane goes down. But our intrepid couple makes a near-miraculous parachute drop, with Matt holding on as Emily guides the parachute to safety. They decide to disappear and start a new life. Everyone will assume they died in the crash. Fast forward 15 years, and they have two kids, and Matt is the coach at the kids' school. Emily is a stay-at-home mom selling stuff on Etsy. Alice, McKenna Roberts, hates her mom. She's 14. Leo, Ryland Jackson, is 10 and plays video games. He can still be intimidated by his dad. Emily becomes suspicious that her daughter is really at a friend's studying, especially since Alice has left her laptop in the living room. Emily discovers the password and learns her daughter is at an adult's club. Emily and Matt swing into action to rescue their daughter and end up in an unfortunate fight at the club. The scene goes viral, their cover is blown, and our story really takes off. A fun movie with good special effects and fun actors. It's especially nice to see Cameron Diaz back after a 10-year absence. Hopefully Diaz and Fox will be paired up again soon in a better movie. For WRT's Monday Movie Review, I'm Harry Richardson.
And that does it for our show. Thank you for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writers this evening were Nate Carlin and Dame Bulow. Kate Poppy and Elliot Hughes were your reporters. Special thanks to feature contributors Harry Richardson, Brenda Conkle, Rebecca Kemble, Christina Liefring, and Charlie Bielowski. Thanks also to Nicholas Leet for technical production and Janine Ramsey for field production. Victor Calzoni engineered the show, Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Sholly Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Rachel Fields.
And I'm your host, Dane Bulow. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is the most free-form show on your radio dial, The Access Hour. Good night.
And you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Support for this program comes from Greater Madison Music City. Through proven strategies, success stories, and challenges, the Music City Circuit, presented by Greater Madison Music City, will highlight music tourism's role as a driver of urban transformation, offering valuable insights on how to shape our future as a music city while empowering our local musicians and music-related businesses. The Music City Circuit, coming soon to select streaming platforms. More information at ourgmmc.org.
Welcome to the Access Hour, where each week WORT offers you the opportunity to fly your program over the radio. The Access Hour is WORT's commitment to community access to the airwaves. For this hour, we have turned the airwaves over to a member of the public. The views expressed on the Access Hour do not represent the views of the station, its staff, programmers, or the board of directors. We'd like this show to be as unpredictable as possible, so we need your creative ideas. It's a fair trade. You give us what you've got, and we give you the facilities and any help you need to get your program airborne. So let your mind wander and wonder. And when the inspiration for some pretty good radio glows with a clear, bright light, get in touch. Just go to WORTFM.org and look on the left side for Sign Up to Host an Access Hour. Programs are scheduled first come, first served. And now it's time to begin another foray into the freest form program on the WORT schedule, the Access Hour.